Many of you might have seen what we enjoyed Monday, the mass fly-in and landing here at Whitman Field. It was truly a work of art. It was very impressive. And tonight we have a number of the DC-3 crews with us in the audience. We welcome you and we thank you if you're part of that great event. And we thank you for bringing the largest conglomeration of DC-3s on one field probably for a long time, maybe even since the war, and a record that will stand for a long time to come. So we thank those who are in the audience that shared our DC-3s all over the field. Man, these things are everywhere. We had a great flyby today, too. And your moderator for tonight's performance on the discussion of the DC-3 and its history is a great friend of EAA and ours. He's Ron Alexander. Ron is a retired Delta captain with more than 24,000 hours of flying time. He's also been involved in antique and experimental aviation for more than 30 years. Now, Ron is a DC-3 owner and operator and has been a valuable resource in planning this year's tribute to the DC-3. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming DC-3 pilot and owner Ron Alexander.
Thank you very much. Well, welcome to the celebration of 75th anniversary celebration of the world's greatest airplane, the DC-3. We have a fantastic program for you this evening. It's divided into three segments. We're going to talk about the history of the DC-3. Then we're going to bring some pilots out who actually flew the airplane during World War II and the early days of airline flying. And then we're going to bring out a few folks who are currently flying the airplane. So let's get started with it. I'm going to first off introduce two gentlemen, Mr. Henry Holden. He is an author and a historian on the DC-3. And Mr. James Douglas, the son of Donald Douglas, is with us this evening. So let's give them a big hand, if you would, please. And Henry is going to begin the program. He has several slides, and he's going to talk to us about the history of the DC-3. Henry?
Thank you, Ron. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We have a pretty accelerated program tonight, so if you have any questions for me, the best way to do that would be to reach me on my website, henrymholden.com. A slide, please. Oh, we have it. Okay, that was Newt Rockne. The evolution of the DC-3 can be traced back to his unfortunate death on March 31st, 1931. Slide, please. He was flying a Fokker F-10 and over Kansas, a wheat field, and they were just entering some turbulence, and the plane crashed in a wheat field with the farmer in the field. The farmer heard the crash, looked up, and saw a wing coming down. The Department of Air Commerce grounded the Fokker F-10 immediately and began to look into what happened. Now, the farmer seeing the wing coming down was a good clue as to where they should begin their investigation. It turns out that Tony Fokker, who had gained worldwide fame during World War I with his German fighter planes, had moved to the United States in 1925 and began building Fokker planes here. His reputation was so stellar that nobody thought access panels to critical parts of the airplane were necessary. When they pulled the wreckage apart and then repieced it, they found out that the wing root had rotted. And there was no way of telling that because there was no way of seeing it. The accident ruined Fokker. He went out of the airplane, he went out of manufacturing the airplane business, and later went in to the Douglas family. But what happened to TWA was Jack Fry, we saw on the previous slide, had two major airplanes. He had the Fokker F-10 and the Ford Trimotor. The Fokkers were grounded. He would go out of business if he didn't get another airplane to substitute for the Fokker. When the Fokker was released to service, nobody flew it. So it just passed away within a year. First, Jack Fry went to Boeing, who was manufacturing the Boeing 247, which was an all-metal monoplane with twin engines. And Boeing said to Fry, we'll gladly build Boeing 247s for you, but we have approximately 75 on order with United Airlines, and we won't be able to fill your order until we fill that order. It turns out that United Technologies owned Pratt & Whitney, Pacific Air Transport, United Airlines, and Varney. So there was no way that Fry was going to get any airplanes out of Boeing for quite a while. So then he wrote a letter to, next slide please. He wrote a letter to Donald Douglas and several other airplane manufacturers. Next slide. Douglas called it the birth certificate of the DC ships. He called Arthur Raymond, his assistant chief engineer, and Dutch Kindleberg, his chief engineer, in, and they examined what Fry was looking for. He wanted a plane that grossed out at 14,000 pounds. It would hold 12 passengers, and it would be made of metal like the Ford, only better. Now, here we have the Douglas engineers working up the specs on what they thought they could deliver. Arthur Raymond was, at the time, assistant chief engineer. He and another engineer, when the specs were finished, took a train to New York City, where TWA was based. And Arthur Raymond, I had the privilege of interviewing him and Dr. W. Bailey Oswald back in 1988, and Raymond said, we took the train to New York for two reasons. We had a hell of a lot of work to do, that's the quote, and he said, we really wanted to get there. In 1933, planes were literally falling out of the sky. In 1929, the year the stock market crashed, they called it also the year of the crashes because 52 airliners went down. So when Raymond got to New York, he presented his plan to TWA, and his plan was a twin-engine monoplane. And Charles Lindbergh, who was the technical advisor to TWA, said, well, if you changed what our specs were, and their specs were a three-motor plane, then we have to change our requirements. And our requirement now is that we're able to fly at our highest altitude, which was about 8,000 feet over the Great Divide, on one engine and fly straight and level. Arthur Raymond got on the phone to Dr. Oswald back in Santa Monica, and the two of them had a feeling they could do it because technology was advancing now in rapid stages. So Raymond said, okay, we can do it. But now Raymond had a dilemma. He wasn't sure exactly what they had. He knew what they were telling him they had, a Ford tri-motor, but he said, I'm going to take it from New York to Kansas City to find out exactly what they have. When he got to Kansas City, he decided he wasn't going to tell Donald Douglas to build a tri-motor. It was a bi-motor or nothing at all. Next slide, please. Back in those days, they didn't have computers. They had slide rules, and they had very, very basic engineering as far as aerodynamics go. That slide you see there is how they measured wing loading. They took lead shot, put it in a bag, and when it had enough of it on the wing and it began to sag, they figured they had reached the loading limit on it. The DC-1 took 58,000 man-hours to build. There were a lot of people involved in it, and they did it in a few months. Next slide. The maiden flight of the DC-1 took place on July 1st, 1933. And the DC-3 almost didn't happen because of that flight. They took off. Carl Cover, the chief engineer, was a very good pilot, and he had a co-pilot with him, and they took off from Santa Monica. And Santa Monica, as you take off, you go down, the ground slopes down. As he took off and began to climb, both engines quit. First the left, then the right. So as what a pilot should do, he pushed the yoke forward and gained airspeed, the engines came back on. So he didn't really give it much concern. He started to climb again, the engines quit again. He put the nose down, the engines came back on. He did it one more time, and one more time the engines came back on when he pulled it up, and he decided to bring it back to base and find out what's going on. What happened was, when they tore the engines apart, they put the carburetors in backwards. Next slide, please. This is a slide of the DC-1. I believe that's Glendale Airport. But what makes it unusual is there's a wheel pant on the tail wheel. They did a lot of experimenting with the DC-1. At one point, they put mounts between the fuselage and the nacelle, thinking that that might help somehow, but nothing did. It was a good plane, and without all the things that they thought would make it better, it worked just as it should have worked. Next slide, please. One of the problems that they had internally, the engineers had, they had a dispute between should they use down locks on the gear or not. The gear collapsed on one occasion when it was taxiing, one of the gears did, and that bolstered the argument that they should have down locks. This slide shows that both gears collapsed, and that convinced them that they had to have down locks on all the rest of the airplanes. Next slide, please. This is a DC-2 production. TWA liked the DC-1 enough to say we want a bunch of changes in it. There were somewhere around 35 or 40 changes they wanted in it, and one of the things was they wanted more seating, so they stretched it to 12 seats. And they immediately, the airlines loved it. TWA took off with it, American Airlines took off with it, Delta Airlines took off with it. Next slide, please. That's a Delta ship right there. The airlines were crazy about it. One reason was it won an international air race, KLM did, the Dutch airline, while it was stopping at its passenger stops. Next slide, please. One of the things people liked about the DC-2 was that looks pretty comfortable, and it was in comparison to the Ford Trimotor. But here the people are dining on real china with real silverware, napkins, and this is the way you used to fly in the first class in the 60s and 70s. Next slide, please. Now, the man who really brought the DC-3 about was C.R. Smith. He was with American Airlines. American was flying the DC-2 and they liked it, but they had some problems with it. They couldn't put passengers in it and fly them to the coast overnight. They had been using Ford Trimotors and Curtiss Condors with bunks in them to fly their people across the country. And mostly it was the rich and famous and the Hollywood people who wanted to get places in 72 hours rather than a week and a half, or a week at least, with the train. The Ford Trimotor could get them to the West Coast or to the East Coast, but they had to fly in the daytime and take the train at night, and the best time they could make was 72 hours. The DC-3 would shorten that time to 8, 10, 12 hours, depending on winds and stops for fuel. C.R. Smith got on the phone with Donald Douglas and spent about 3 hours convincing him that he could build a new airplane out of the DC-2 that would meet his requirements of flying people back and forth comfortably in an airplane. They agreed on the phone to the conditions that C.R. Smith was laying out, and Smith followed it up with a telegram on July 8th, 1935. The actual contract, and this gives you an idea of the integrity that both men had, the actual contract was signed April 8th, 1936, which was long after the DC-3 was flying. Next slide, please. This is the DST that C.R. Smith was pushing for. You can see there above the words, the Great Silver Fleet, there are four little black squares. Those are windows for the upper berths. Next slide. Next slide, please. The way they loaded the berths, the way they calculated the requirements for them, again, was with lead shot in bags. They didn't have anything more than a computer. And next slide. It worked perfectly. If you look on the upper berth, right behind that woman's elbow is the window for the upper berth and the two for the bottom. Now, the window was a result of one of the Douglas engineers getting in the mock-up and feeling like he was being claustrophobic. So they decided to cut a window, and that relieved anybody if they had any claustrophobia. By 1936, American Airlines was finally making money. All of the airlines had been subsidized by the government to fly airmail. 1936, they made their first $4,500 profit. By 1937, they were making $1.4 million in profit. The DC-3 was paying for itself by just flying people. By 1939, 90% of the airlines in the world were using DC-3 equipment. Next slide. This is the first DC-3 off the line, Flagship Texas. It's a night shot. It's difficult to see, but the windows are on the right above the right above the main windows and below the American Airlines logo. Next slide. And back in 1937, the Army knew that war was coming and they needed a transport plane. So Douglas began to look at the DC-3 and see what he could do with it. But in the interim, they took DC-2s and put DC-3 tails on it and they were able to meet the Army's requirements temporarily. But by December 7, 1941, Douglas had orders for 947 DC-3/C-47s. By 1942, he had orders for 5,000 of them. Slide, please. This gives you a scale of the size of the wing section. There's a man in that lower part of the picture, riveting, or I guess. Next slide. The C-47 was found everywhere, on every Army air base in many numbers. Slide. This is the C-47 assembly line. On the left is the center section, and the center is the cockpit section, and on the right is the fuselage section, and probably just out of the picture is the tail section. They were used extensively for gliders in World War II in Sicily and throughout Europe. Slide. Here it's tugging a CG-4 glider. It could tug two CG-4 gliders or one English Horser glider. By May 1944, the Oklahoma City plant was pumping out 1.8 C-47s an hour. Between Long Beach and Santa Monica, they were in a 30-day period, they were pumping out 18.5 C-47s a day.